Good afternoon, Anastasia.
It is morning here. And it's afternoon where you are.
It is afternoon where I am.
And that's how time zones work.
Yes. It's amazing that we can do a podcast like this when we are in very different parts of the world.
Yes.
But hey, we wouldn't have met if it wasn't for tennis.
But we wouldn't. You know, technology is a good thing sometimes, but we wouldn't have met if it wasn't for tennis and the internet and all that good stuff. So sometimes the internet can be good, you know.
Sometimes technology could be good. It did hate us for the other part of this podcast, which I don't know if this is going to get stitched into the middle of what we're recording here or whether you're hearing us half after hearing the technical difficulties. But if this is before, I apologize in advance, particularly for my audio, which just would not work. So it's going to be ground pass today.
Yeah, it was just one of those days where everything went wrong. And it's funny because I'm such an A-type person who, you know, I have all the schedules and I have this and, you know, this is how it's going to work and everything. And my internet went out, so I had to run down to a coffee store to do the recording. And then I couldn't really hear Nick for some reason. So I just was kind of hoping he was talking at some points and I wasn't talking over him. But it was one of those technology like black holes of a day. And we got to talk to
It's Will Buchek from the Tennis Tribe, which is a website and podcast that Will set up specifically to cover the doubles game, which is not actually something we've talked much about on Ground Pass. We've done a little bit, but because there's some changes coming up in the way doubles formatting works, as they're experimenting with a few different things, we thought it'd be a good opportunity for those of you who may be following tennis to kind of get introduction to doubles, who some of the big names are, who Will is, because he's really good to follow for that kind of thing, and also get an idea of what the norm is and what's changing. And I think that was a really good discussion, not just if you're a new tennis fan, but also if you're an existing tennis fan for the direction of the sport's going to go.
Yeah, so we'll insert the audio of that interview here. And the reason why you might be thinking, oh, doubles, why all of a sudden are you talking about doubles, is because all the changes are coming in the next tournament that's coming up, the Madrid Open, which we'll be talking about shortly. But here is our interview with Will.
Welcome. It's Ground Pass. We're back. Hopefully you're not sick of the sound of my voice. And we are actually coming to you live from a coffee shop somewhere. So if you hear any strange noises, that's what's going on. And when I say we, I mean one of us, but I'm not going to say which one of us. But you're actually going to hear...
If you hear any coffee grinding, it's live from Brooklyn.
Everyone, get a coffee, settle down, listen to the podcast, come join us. Coffee and tennis, great combo. As I can see, our guest is also sipping a coffee. You will hear three voices today rather than your usual two. And that's because we've got Will Buchek from the Tennis Tribe with us this week for this episode of Ground Pass. Hello, Will. Welcome to the chaos.
Hey, y'all. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm excited to be here and talk doubles.
Yeah, and we are here to talk doubles because, you know, for those of us who have been regular listeners with us for a while, we've been talking a lot about singles, and tennis does talk a lot about singles in general, the way it's marketed, or that's the matches that get put kind of in the prime time. But there is doubles as well. And arguably, doubles might be something that a lot more people are familiar with if you play tennis. But we wanted to get Will on because, A, it was a good opportunity to talk about doubles and getting into that, but also some changes that the ATP are going to be experimenting with the current format that doubles plays. But I've talked enough, so I guess let's hear a bit more about Will. So, Will, there's probably going to be a lot of newer tennis fans on who probably aren't as familiar with you and who you are and what you do. So do you want to give us a bit of introduction?
Yeah, sure. I grew up playing tennis most of my life, kind of off and on. And then I started a Tennis Tribe back in 2016. And it actually started kind of as a doubles blog. So I'm very interested in like strategy and like all the moving pieces on the doubles court and giving advice to people on how to improve their game. So I started writing doubles lessons on my blog and in my newsletter, which I still do today. And then from there, in around 2020, really around COVID, when tennis kind of made a comeback and maybe a little bit before COVID, I started to look at professional tennis and realized that there is nobody who covers professional doubles and it's really hard to find on TV. And I was like, I was looking for a reason for it. Honestly, I was like kind of searching, asking questions. I started my podcast and started interviewing pro doubles players. And I was looking for some reason that like made sense to me where it's like, oh, well, this is why doubles can never be super popular. And I couldn't find a good one. Like none of them made sense to me. So I was like, okay, well, I'm going to try to help make doubles more popular until I feel like I've done everything I can. And still to this day, I just don't have a good reason as to why doubles isn't more popular or at least close to as popular as singles. Because like you said, most people, most adult tennis players are playing doubles. So since 2020, I've had the podcast going. I've started traveling to a lot of tournaments and covering the doubles. I met Anastasia in Miami, in a lot of the post-match interviews and press conferences that I know both of you have done for Talking Tennis as well. You know, I'll submit these requests for doubles teams and doubles players, and you'll go to the singles pressers and there will be, you know, two, three, up to maybe 10 or 12 or 15 people at all of these. And in Miami, for example, I did 8 different post-match interviews. And 7 of the 8, it was just me. And one of them, there was one other person.
Wow.
So I'm literally almost the only person in the world who's covering this stuff. And it doesn't make sense to me. And I'm trying to help grow it and make it more popular.
See, that's so interesting to hear because, you know, there are definitely some singles players who are not more popular. So I would go to their pressers and it'd be me and just me and one person or something like that. But there are a few doubles teams that are pretty popular that have some sort of name value. And especially at a 1000 event, like this wasn't a 250 in the middle of the country. This was the Miami Open, which is part of the Sunshine Double. And it's just so surprising to me that
yeah,
it was just you. You were the only one there covering
yeah.
doubles.
Yeah, I mean, I got 10 minutes with like with Bethany Maddox-Sands and Sophia Kennan, and it was just me. So it's like, I don't know what more like, and they won,
and they
ended
the
up winning
tournament.
The tournament. Yeah. This was after their like second round win, but Bethany Maddox-Sands is like as much as a star power as
it's a huge,
get in,
yeah.
in doubles anyways. And like, yeah, she had 10 minutes to sit and chat with me and it was a great conversation. But yeah, it just doesn't make sense to me. So I think, you know, a lot of the changes that are potentially coming, which I'm sure we'll talk about, could be potentially positive for doubles. And I'm hoping that the tours continue to experiment and more people start to cover it so that I'm not the only one doing these post-match interviews.
Yeah. Well, before we get into, I think, the changes coming into doubles, a few questions for you that I kind of want to start asking guests that come on the show. What is your favorite tournament? Do you have a favorite tournament to watch doubles at?
I mean, the Grand Slams are better because the format's different. So for people who don't know, at all the non-Grand Slam tournaments, it's no ad, and then you play a 10-point tiebreaker instead of a third set. So it's a very shortened format. The Grand Slams is full 2 out of 3 with ad. So that is my preference because it's just longer matches. And it increases the likelihood that the better team's going to win, which I think is a little more fair. But there are format changes to the scoring that I would like to see, which we can get into. I went to the Australian Open in 2020. I think that was probably my favorite tournament to attend. I think they put on such a great, great product for the fans. So that's probably number one for me.
Okay.
Just a quick thing from me before we jump to the next question. For people who maybe are a little bit familiar, when we talk about ad, we are talking about advantage. So instead of playing first two clear points in a doubles game, especially on the main tour, as we said, so Grand Slams are the exception.
Yep.
Deuce is like a sudden death point. Winner the point takes the game.
Yeah. They call it deciding point. So you'll hear the chair umpire. And I've watched so much doubles at this point at these tournaments. When I go to a singles court and I hear the chair umpire say deuce, I'm expecting them to say receiver's choice afterwards because they'll say deciding point, receiver's choice. So the receiving team can choose which side that deuce point goes to. So they can actually take it to the ad side, even though it's deuce.
There's already so much to learn as someone who primarily watches singles with the differences in the doubles game, but there's even more changes coming. And I kind of want to go back to the history of this and why I wanted to have you on the podcast is because earlier in the year, I think this was after the Australian Open, Jamie Murray gave an interview to Tennis Majors, and I will put the article in our show notes. And it was almost a sad article. I remember reading it thinking, oh no, like he thinks there'll be no more doubles by the end of the year. Or like it was a very sort of somber article about the current state of the doubles game and where it was going. And if changes didn't happen, we might not have doubles competition. And as someone who goes to a lot of tournaments, I do see that a little bit where you'll have a packed singles court and right next door, there are like four people watching doubles. And I've always wondered why that is. I mean, I, as a tennis lover, I think I definitely started as a singles, like I watched only singles, but doubles came very quickly after. And I think this will kind of bring us into the changes that the ATP is making to the doubles game. And I'm not even sure if the WTA is doing the same changes. Are they?
Not currently.
Or it's just ATP? Okay.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Because...
Go on, Will. Yeah.
Yeah. Because how I got into doubles was because the Williams sisters were playing doubles. Like, they were my entry into tennis. And then, you know, they would obviously have their singles career, but then they would play doubles together. So I was like, oh, this is great. More tennis. And that was my entry into doubles. And it seems like part of the solution that the ATP are going towards is doing this. So that brings us to Madrid. The Madrid Open is the tournament that's coming up. It's the one that we're going to talk about. And for everyone listening to the podcast, we're recording this with Will on Friday. Nick and I are still going to do a recording on Sunday, catching up on all the tournaments that have happened and like what's coming up. But Madrid is coming up. And the ATP have introduced a few changes to the doubles tournament that's going to come up in Madrid. Quite similar, I think, to what we talked about when we were talking about Next Gen and how they introduced a few new things. So, Will, could you give us a rundown of what these changes are coming up?
Yeah, so I've actually got the article pulled up from atptour.com. The first bullet they have is more singles versus doubles action. So they're going to reserve, it's a 32-team draw, they're going to reserve up to 16 slots for teams entering via their single ranking. So I believe that means both players from those 16 teams are going to get in on a singles ranking. This is something I'm still not clear on, like how it's going to work if a singles player plays with a doubles player. Like Sasha Zverev plays with Marcelo Melo sometimes, right? And Marcelo Melo does not have a singles ranking, or if he does, yeah, it's not relevant. So I don't know how that is going to work, but the idea behind this, I believe, is to create more matches where it's two singles players against two doubles, quote, specialists. So that's the first one. Go ahead.
Yeah. And I was going to say, full disclosure, I watch doubles matches here and there, but the only doubles tournament that I watched from round one to the finals was the last Madrid Open, where Rublev played with Khachanov. Yeah. And I just thought, they're hilarious. That's a fun team to watch. So I watched them all the way through, and then they won the tournament. So it's interesting that it's in Madrid now that they're bringing all these new changes.
So that's a good point, because the singles players, when you watch them play, like Rublev and Khachanov and Hurkacz will play doubles some, you'll see them not take it so seriously, and they'll make a lot of jokes on the court, and they'll be really entertaining. And it's something that does add value to the fan experience, I think. And it's something that I feel like doubles players themselves need to start to kind of do a little bit more of as well. It's hard because like this is their main source of income, right? Like if they lose, like they're out significantly on a paycheck, whereas the singles players don't really need the money. So they treat it very much like a lot more business-like, right? A lot more seriously. So you have to strike that balance. But the Bryan brothers were great at this, doing all the chest bumping and jumping around and getting into it with the fans. And it's something that helps. It creates a better fan experience, and it creates more doubles fans as well. So that's a good point. So streamlined schedule over 5 days. So as these 1,000 level events shift to 2 weeks, it seems like what they're pushing towards is the doubles is going to be during week two, and it's going to only be Tuesday through Saturday. And the reason for that is singles players like a Rublev or Jannik Sinner or whoever who lose in the first two or three rounds can then enter the doubles draw late.
So that was a big question I had, because I was like, wait, why are they doing this? I didn't realize you could enter late, because I was like, that could be the only reason,
right? Yeah, so that's the idea behind it, is to get a few more singles players in there that that can, you know, draw some fans to some of those matches, and then draw some TV viewers potentially if they get it on TV. I think that how this will work is they'll play every single day. And the doubles players I've talked to have no problem playing back-to-back-to-back days. Obviously, doubles is a lot less kind of taxing and grueling on the body than singles. So it's a little bit easier to do that. So anyways, that's the idea behind that, I believe. And then the next two have to do with the pace of play. So a reduced shot clock. They're reducing it to 15 seconds for rallies that are shorter than four shots. Honestly, I think that one's kind of dumb. I don't think it's going to make a big impact. I don't see the point in it. I think it's going to be confusing for the chair umpire to see, like, is it a four-shot rally or a five-shot rally? I don't know. I don't really have a good explanation for that. And then quicker changeovers. So this is a kind of a good one. So fewer sit downs to accelerate pace of play. So I believe what they're going to do is no sit downs during the first set. So they'll change sides. They'll grab a quick drink of water, but they won't sit and take that 90 seconds. Again, the doubles players I've talked to are typically okay with this. They really don't need 90 seconds between changeovers, especially in that first set. I like the idea of this, and then maybe they could do some kind of longer set break, like maybe 3 or 5 minutes or something. That would create opportunities for the tournament to like do something fun on the court. So I talked with Philip Fama about this last week on his show. He has a YouTube channel called Tweenerhead. We talked about like how in the NBA, during the halftime show, you'll have like entertainment, right? So they could do something like that between sets if there was like a 5-minute break, or somebody comes out and tries to hit a target with their serve, or like they grab a fan from the stands to try to do some kind of contest or challenge. Something that's like kind of entertaining. This is not a change they're making. This is something that I'm kind of suggesting. The last change is free fan movement, which is huge. This is my favorite one. It's really, I think, the only one that's going to make a huge impact. So allowing fans to move in and out of the stadium and not wait for a changeover. And this is something that tennis people have complained about for a long time. Singles is probably not going to budge on it. So I'm glad that doubles is doing that.
I think singles is, did they do something like a test in Australia or something?
I think it was for the doubles courts though, wasn't it?
They did something, I think. I can't remember which tournament it was.
I'm not sure.
I thought it was for the singles as well. Was it Next Gen?
Maybe it was, because I know for sure they tested it out at Next Gen, but I thought there was something about it in Australia. And the only reason I remember is because it happened during like a Novak match and he was upset, as always.
It's interesting, Will, you're saying you're not thinking singles was going to budge on it, because actually, for me, listening to a lot of these changes, they sound like things that you would experiment with to put into singles eventually to see if it works. Like doubles is the perfect testing ground. So like the staggered shot clock I'm thinking of particularly there, but also the free fan movement. Interestingly, on the free fan movement thing, I do have to say it's mostly Americans who want it. The Europeans are quite happy to sit still.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I've not heard that before. That's interesting. I think you're right. What I meant by singles won't budge on it is they won't budge first on it. I do think it's something that if it works in doubles, singles may adopt it. I'm sure there'll always be some people who are not happy about it, but, I didn't know it was mostly an American thing. I mean, it drives me crazy. Like when I'm at the US Open and sitting outside court 17 and I have to sit there for three games, like I just don't want to do that. And the story I've used is to illustrate this is last year. So I was with a group of friends. We brought somebody who lived in New York, who's not a tennis player, not a tennis fan, to the tournament for the first time. It was their first ever professional tennis event. And I imagine them like going to the singles court. They have to sit there for, you know, 5-10 minutes and wait outside the stadium. And then they get to go in. And it's just like a really bad fan experience. And then if I was able to bring them over to the doubles court and they're able to go in and out and go grab a beer and come back immediately, they'd be like, hey, I don't really want to go over to the singles anymore. I want to watch the doubles. This is more fun. Like there's more movement. There's more energy. Like this is a lot more fun for me. So if we're thinking about like growing the sport, and this will, I think it will work for singles too, but like I said, I think doubles will have to budge on it first. I think that, you know, creating a better fan experience for new fans like that, this is a huge thing that has to happen, because there's just no other sports that are like that really off the top of my head that I can think of. And it makes it not that entertaining.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, you know, to kind of expand on the entertainment and I don't know, have any of you watched or listened to, I mean, it's on YouTube as well, but Andy Roddick just interviewed the Bryan brothers. Listening to them, they were also a doubles team that I latched onto only because, like you said, they were fun. First of all, they were twins. So that was like the first, you know, they were like twins who played doubles, and that there was definitely like an allure there. But then when you did watch them, they were really fun. They were really big and fierce. They did the chest bump thing. So there was something you would latch onto and become a fan of the Bryan brothers. But, you know, they were talking about little things like they mentioned something about like, what if doubles players, like on their shirts, they had their names on the back.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like how basketball players have their name on the back and you kind of latch onto things like that. And because again, unfortunately, at least currently, a lot of people just don't know who doubles players are. You know, if your name's not Jamie Murray or Neil Skupski,
yeah,
I mean, even Neil Skupski is a stretch. Jamie Murray.
Outside of the UK.
Yeah. Jamie Murray, I think people know it's kind of like, how do you make these players a little bit more entertaining for people to watch? And because I think they are great personalities in the end. It's just no one knows who they are in order to latch onto them. So I thought that was a very interesting point he made. Like, what if they had jerseys with their names on the back?
I think that would help. Obviously, like, for the actual tournaments and people attending. But this, like, this kind of goes back to a higher level overview of doubles. And, like, I talked with Matt Ebden about this on my podcast at Indian Wells. It goes back to a product versus, like, a marketing problem. So, like, all of these changes that they're making right now are mostly really to the product. Like, the shot clock, that's changing the product. The schedule is changing the product. More singles versus doubles action is changing the product. Even the fan movement is like, that's helping marketing a little bit because they're like getting more eyeballs on the product quicker. But overall, it's not really a marketing change. So I think, in my opinion, and, you know, based on talking with probably 50 plus pro players, and then, you know, another 50 plus coaches and media people, and I think doubles mostly has a marketing problem rather than a product problem. Depending on the country, certainly in the US, when you attend the tournaments at Indian Wells or Miami, a lot of the doubles courts are packed out, even if it's for doubles specialists, because people love watching doubles, and it's like there's some very entertaining points. So if we can better market the players and get to where Neil Skupski, who won Wimbledon last year, is like well known by all tennis fans around the world, like I think people are going to go to the doubles court and watch Neil Skupski, like, because the product is a lot of fun to watch. But people don't know who he is because they don't have a marketing budget for doubles. If you follow the ATP or WTA on Twitter and Instagram, and WTA has done a better job the last few years, but, you know, it's like one out of every 100 tweets or Instagram posts is about doubles at best. But you go to the tournament and it's like 25% of the tournament. So it's like maybe 25% of your posts should be about 25% of your product. So it's just really...
Yeah, and it's funny coming to sort of the WTA side of it, because we've talked a lot about ATP and because most of the changes are coming to the ATP side. But I think the thing that doubles has on the WTA side is a lot of singles players just play doubles anyway. Top singles players like Coco Gauff and Jessica Pegula, they play doubles all the time, you know? So it's almost like they have like an equal singles doubles ratio. So when I was at Indian Wells, for example, all of Coco and Pegula's doubles matches were absolutely packed. There were lines outside because people knew them from singles. So it was easy to just transfer that over to doubles. And maybe that's what the ATP is trying to do with trying to encourage more singles players to play doubles.
I think they are trying to do that with the A, the 16 single slots, and then B, the streamlined schedule to allow more of those players. But like the Coco Gauff and Jessica Pegula example is a great one because at Indian Wells, I talked to, you know, I attended one of their matches and talked to some of the fans, and they're like, a few of them said, we like watching Coco play doubles more than singles. So like it's just an example of a few people, but it kind of illustrates like that doubles doesn't have a product problem. It's more of a marketing problem because people don't care if they watch Coco Gauff play singles or doubles. They just want to watch Coco Gauff because she's a star. And she's a star because of her singles, because the tours marketed her as a singles player, right? If doubles had 99% of the marketing, then people would know Coco Gauff as a doubles player. And they'd happen to go watch her play singles as well. Because so I think it really does kind of, all these changes are great. I'm glad they're experimenting first and foremost. I don't necessarily agree with all of the changes, but I'm not that worried about it. I'd rather them make changes and try stuff out than do nothing. but I want to see more changes in the marketing side, which is not something they can just do in one tournament. It's a little bit more difficult, you know, that goes into your kind of deeper business plan, right? I guess.
Well, looking forward to the Madrid tournament. So the Madrid tournament is a 1,000 level event. We're going to stick with doubles here. Nick and I later in the week will look at the singles field and all of that. Who should our audience look out for? You know, we're going to try and promote they watch doubles this coming tournament. So who are the doubles teams that you like out there who are doing well, who they can follow through the season?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what singles players team up for Madrid with the new changes. I guess storyline of the year has been Rohan Bopanna. He's 44 years old. He won the Australian Open at 43. He and Matt Ebden, who I mentioned earlier, won the Australian Open. They are number one in the race right now, and playing at a very high level. So that's probably the number one storyline so far this year. I don't know if you saw in Monte Carlo, Rohan did a video with Novak, because they were both world number one at a combined age of 80, I believe. Kind of funny. So they've been the top team probably so far this year, but there's so much depth on the doubles tour as far as these doubles teams go. So in Monte Carlo, Sander Gilles and Joran Vliegen, they're up to six in the race. They were probably sitting around like 20 before that tournament, but you know, they're a very good team. So like they get through the Masters 1000 event and win the thing. Wesley Kuhlhoff and Nikola Mektić are a really good team to watch. They're number two in the race right now. They won Indian Wells earlier this year. I spoke with them in Miami, and Wesley said he wants to win another major. He made it very clear that he wants to win another major before he retires, and this is his last year. Yeah, so those are a few of the teams to watch. I mean, there's a lot more I could go through, but...
What singles pairings so far that have happened this year have you kind of enjoyed? I would say Sinner and Sonego have been doing pretty fun. Yeah. You know, they've been having some good times.
over the years, I mean, you mentioned Rublev and Khachanov. They've been a solid doubles team over the years, and they're... Rublev is actually a good doubles player, even though he doesn't have like the best volleys, because he takes the ball so early. So he steps like he takes everything at or like inside the baseline. And what that does is it takes away any time the net player has to poach. So he's actually a pretty good doubles player, and they're both great returners. Hurkacz has done well over the years as well. He's a pretty solid doubles player. He won Miami with Isner, I believe, 2 years ago, when Isner went on that run. As far as this year, I mean, I'm not sure any singles players have made super deep runs in any of the big tournaments. None come to mind anyways. What's that? Oh, yeah, on the women's side. I was thinking ATP, but yeah, Kennan and Maddox Sands won Miami, and Kennan is obviously more of a singles player, but she's improved her doubles game a lot. And I spoke with them after that second round win, and Bethany actually shared some like specific drills that she did with Sophia to make her a better doubles player, which was kind of entertaining. I mean, Bethany's so entertaining anyways, but it was kind of fun to listen to that. Coco and Jess are great on the women's side. Krejcikova's been a good, and Siniakova have both been really good doubles players for a long time, who also play singles at a high level. There's a lot more on the women's side, as you said.
Surprising Ons and Paula Badosa, who just teamed up for Stuttgart. That was actually, I watched one of their doubles matches, and I was surprised how not only their sort of chemistry on court, but it was actually a pretty good match. I was really impressed.
Yeah, they won that first round match, and I think they withdrew yesterday. Mm-hmm. Against Maddox Sands. Yeah. But that's actually, I'm glad you brought that up. That's one of the reasons for that later start too, that condensed 5-day schedule to start week two is so that the singles players don't do that. Like they don't win a round and use doubles as a way to get a match on the courts, get a feel for the surface, and then back out in round two, because it's really, you know, not fair for anyone for them to do that. By starting week two, they'll be out of the singles draw theoretically, and then enter, and they'll have a idea if they want to play doubles or not.
Well, I mean, well, this has been a really great conversation. I'm going to link to all of the sort of interviews you did with these players in our show notes. But just as a conclusion, like, what are you hoping? I mean, what's happening in Madrid is a complete experiment. We're all going to watch it together and see if it works or not. But what are you hoping going forward that both towards the ATP and the WTA, what would you like to see them do in order to help by the end of the season, we see a significant, if not significant, but at least a step forward in the doubles game?
I mean, the number one thing for me is marketing. I'll send you a link. So I'm doing a survey right now. So if the listeners can take 2 minutes and fill it out, I'll send you a link to it. Matt Ebden actually reached out to me and asked me to do this, and he's on the ATP Players Council, and he's kind of behind a lot of these changes you're seeing in Madrid. So we're doing some kind of research to try to figure out what people want and figure out, maybe how to get doubles on TV more. But the number one thing I'd want to see is just better marketing for the doubles. Because like I said, I just really don't believe that doubles has a product problem. Like, I think it's entertaining. I think one thing Matt said in our interview is if you can market pickleball, we should be able to market doubles. And I think that's totally fair. Like, I think that's really totally fair. So marketing's definitely number one for me. I'm glad they're making experiments, or experimenting with the product as well. The free fan movement is huge, I think. But better marketing overall is number one.
Awesome. Well, thank you for joining. Nick had to jump on to his next meeting. And we'll talk soon, hopefully with a better internet connection.
No problem. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks a ton for having me.
That was a great interview with Will. Thankful that he came onto the show to talk to us about doubles. And I learned a lot from the conversation. I will link his blog and his podcast in our show notes so you can follow up on all the interviews that he does. I was most fascinated by the fact that, so I met Will at the Miami Open, and I was just blown away by the fact that with all the interview requests that players were getting, like, he was, for the most part, the only one showing up to interview doubles players, which is kind of a sad state. And I think it kind of says a lot about where doubles is at. And I hope with these experiments that the ATP is doing and that the WTA, I'm sure, will follow, we can get people more involved in doubles, because they can be really fun. They can be really, really fun.
Doubles is so much fun. I mean, when I talked to my dad about tennis, he said he much prefers watching doubles, mostly because he prefers quicker points. But I think, you know, doubles, you get such a very different dynamic. You get very different tactics. The team game, the teams involved can be really, really fun. I mean, like, you and I were absolutely loving Taylor last year. That's Taylor Townsend,
yes,
Fernandez on the WTA side.
Two
of my favorite players teaming up, which was fantastic to see. But also, actually, doubles is great to visit if you're going on a ground pass, because the deeper you go into a tournament, the more doubles there is to see. And whilst it's great to see the single stars and see the big stories unfold of what gets more attention during a tournament, of seeing who the individual best player in the world is, doubles is great tennis still. You get to let on a few more names. You get to see a few more personalities. You know, you might not be able to make the first couple of days when tennis is absolutely packed with singles, but you can make some doubles action later on. Tickets in the second week are often, particularly at slams as well. So go and check them out. It's well worth doing.
And I think if the players embrace the fun of doubles a little bit more, it can actually be a good time. Like, some of the most fun matches I watched last year at the US Open
not only was it between Taylor and Layla Fernandez, but Taylor Townsend played with Ben Shelton in mixed doubles. Those were such a good time. Like, they were the dynamic duo, and it was such a fun time, and everyone was just having fun because, yes, there were stakes involved. You know, they had to win their match to get into the next round, but you could still tell they had so much fun, like, coming up with their little celebrations after each point they won. And, you know, it was a really, really good time. And something that happened at the beginning. So at the beginning of all these tournaments, there's sometimes sort of, you know, like a exhibition type event or something like that. And Indian Wells did one called the Tiebreak Tens, where it was teams of singles players playing against each other. That was fun as well. So if little things like that start involving doubles specialists, because there's some players who all they do is play doubles. So that's why I think people go to doubles matches and they're like, oh, who's that? It's because they're specifically doubles players and they don't play singles. I hope they can include doubles players in these like exhibition style matches and introduce them more to the fan base of tennis.
Yeah. And it's a good time to get to know them as well, because it's an Olympic year and doubles is in the Olympics. And, you know, there will be players out there who will be kind of gearing up to a double specialist. Now, a lot of the people who won medals at the last Olympics in Tokyo, they ended up being singles players who had tried their hand at doubles, particularly in like the mixed. But if you look at, I'm thinking particularly of Croatia won gold in the men's doubles. Like, that was a team of two people who came together specifically because they wanted to win an Olympic medal for Croatia. And they were Nikola Mektić and Matt Pavic. And they are double specialists. You won't see them have much success on the singles court, but they did the job. They got the job done. Or names you might recognize from the singles world: Barbora Krejčíková came up through doubles with Katerina Siniaková, and they're like childhood friends. They have played doubles with each other since they were teenagers, and they have dominated the women's doubles scene. And they got the medal for Czechia, the gold medal for Czechia in the women's doubles. So I guess my overall point is, you know, get to know these players because they will become stars during the Olympics. That's when people start counting.
Yeah. That just reminded me, I'm going to also put a link to another podcast, the Served podcast with Andy Roddick, because he just happened to have interviewed the Bryan brothers, which arguably are one of the most famous doubles pairings. They are twin brothers. So I think that was always very fascinating, watching twin brothers play doubles together. And they were pretty successful in their heyday.
They got prime billing at the US Open. I remember like 10 years ago, like following the US Open, and like their matches were on Ash or Louis Armstrong. Like, that is how big doubles got, because the Bryan brothers were it.
They were. I was also going to say one of the Bryan brothers, I can't remember which one, is the reason why Andy Murray has a metal hip, because he did it first. Okay, so that is our doubles chat. You know, going into Madrid, it will be interesting to see what double pairings we get. We'll talk about that in a bit, but let's discuss what's been going on tour over the last 2 weeks. I hope everyone loved Nick's mini pod that came in between. I loved it. I do all of our editing, and I remember listening to it and thinking, oh my goodness, this is such a great, soothing, calming catch up.
I'm hoping no one fell asleep. Not too many people fell asleep. Unless you have insomnia, in which case I really hope you fell asleep.
I thought it just wasn't what I was expecting. So editing it, I was like, oh, this is so nice. It's a calm, relaxing catch up of the tennis. So I really hope you liked that. I think it will help, you know, reduce how much we have to like catch up on, like, you know, weeks and weeks of tennis in one episode. So if you haven't listened to that, just go back an episode in your podcast feed and you'll find Nick's rundown of the week.
I mean, you say this, Anastasia, I may like, you're probably not going to miss that much, because the story of Monte Carlo has ended up being very similar to the story of Barcelona, because the same players are in the title.
It was rinse and repeat. Let's try it again. Let's see if Casper Ruud can pull off a win this time.
Which we don't know yet, because as of recording, that match doesn't start for another hour. And Anastasia actually talking, and I were talking about this just before we started recording, is that we're going to try and keep you up to date with all the stories as much as possible, but we are not a results-driven podcast in terms of like telling you everything that happened. We're going to just be telling you what the developing stories are. We may not necessarily be able to tell you how some of them ended, just because of how our schedules are aligning. So we don't know who's won the Barcelona Open. We don't know if Stefanos Tsitsipas is going to win the Barcelona title at his fourth attempt, because he's lost three finals before. We don't know if Casper Ruud has got his revenge over Tsitsipas for the Monte Carlo final, which hopefully you remember I talked about if you hadn't fallen asleep. But that's kind of how... I'm kind of stealing your bit here, Anastasia, because that's kind of the final lineup for Barcelona. But I wanted to put that out there of, we'll tell you what's kind of going on and maybe some of the stories that are being set up. But if you want to know what happened, you may have to Google the results or wait for the next mini pod.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really interesting because the way how the results anyway of how Monte Carlo has now, Barcelona has mirrored Monte Carlo is actually pretty helpful, because just as everything, life happens in our week. And I had a really busy week, so I actually didn't watch much of Barcelona. Like, most of my tennis watching was actually taken up by Munich, because those were the matches that interested me at the time. And by the time I had time to catch up on matches, I was exhausted from work. So I didn't really get to watch much of Barcelona. But we requested from our listeners over the past 2 weeks to send us, if you're in Barcelona, if you went to Monte Carlo, if you, you know, visited any of these tournaments that are happening, please send us either a voice note or an email. Nick read a very beautiful email that was so relevant from Monte Carlo. Michelle sent us an email about her experience at Monte Carlo, which was very hilarious because it involved Novak Djokovic and her baby at the time. So go back and listen to that. That was really, really fun. Thank you, Michelle, for sending us an email. And this week, we have an email from Elena, who is also a listener, who was at Barcelona. So she is doing the hard work for us, but also, you know, giving us sort of color of what's happening, what attending the Barcelona tournament is like. So I'm going to insert Elena's voice note here, and we'll be back in a few.
Hi, everyone. Here's Elna, and I would like to share some of my impressions of the Barcelona Open, which I have been attending the last days. So all in all, I have really loved the tournament. Starting from the location, of course, Barcelona is such a vibrant city with ample cultural aspects. It has this beautiful, dreamy architecture of Gaudí, the beaches, delicious food, and of course, I could go on and on about Barcelona. The tournament itself, being an ATP 500, has the advantage that a day ticket offers you the opportunity to watch all the matches, both at the peripheral and the central courts. And it is not divided into a day and night session, as is in the case, for example, in the 1,000 tournaments, which sell different tickets for those. So hopefully with the plan circulating about the Premier Tour, the 250s and the 500s will not be downgraded. This would be a pity. The tournament is the oldest held in Spain. The venue itself, the Real Club de Tenis de Barcelona, has a very long history of around 125 years. And it is a well-lived and frequented club, and this becomes apparent as the audience consists of a great part of Barcelona natives who are meeting there with friends to watch the tennis, and all in all, it gives a very cozy atmosphere. The audience appears to have an in-depth tennis knowledge and culture itself, and I was very pleased to hear of discussions, for example, about Alex de Minaur's ascent to the top 10 or the Master 1000 finals Casper Ruud has reached, or the first title of Diaz Acosta in Argentina earlier this year. They do a lot of stuff for fans too, which is very nice. So I tried my hand on a game called Who's Game from the Top Tennis Players is Your Game Most Similar. So you have to practice forehands and backhands and serves, and they capture rounds per minute and also grid and stance, and was a lot of fun, and I was very, very pleased that I got Roger Federer as a result. So yeah, but the tennis matches, I was here from Wednesday to the finals, so really got the opportunity to watch many matches. And from the peripheral court, where you have the opportunity to sit courtside and appreciate the shot making, I watched, for example, Arthur Fils taking flight against the crazy defenses of Alex de Minaur, which was a match with very loud support for both players, always nice to see in smaller courts. Or I could also appreciate the crafty play of Diaz Acosta, combining his flat backhands with follow through with a lefty forehand with interchanging shape and slices to rattle the flashy and aggressive play of Fabian Marozsen. But the two matches which mostly impressed me were on pista Rafael Nadal, the first one being the heroics of Stefanos Tsitsipas winning a third set tiebreak against the aforementioned Diaz Acosta and regaining his confidence and his all-around game, as we had seen in Monte Carlo. But the match which will definitely be the highlight of this tournament for me was to watch Rafa on Wednesday. And even if he lost, it was nearly otherworldly, this experience. So the force of nature that Rafa is, but also the adoration of the crowd, how they wheeled him on, how they cheered for him, the feet stomping when you would think the whole stadium would go down, the love, the respect, it was amazing to see. And it nearly worked too when Rafa made the comeback and played a competitive first set. But at this point, his serve and his movement are visibly compromised. And for example, he didn't chase the many drop shots that Alex de Minaur threw at him. And one thought that he didn't want to take great risks. That being said, this was only the second match on clay, and since he's already in Madrid and training, I think he's trying to be as competitive as possible for a last dance in Roland Garros, and we would all hope this for him, of course. So this is it for my Barcelona sum up. I will definitely recommend it for you guys. So cheers and keep enjoying tennis.
That was awesome. I love listening to these voice notes from listeners of the podcast, friends of the podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time, Elena, of letting us know what the Barcelona Open is like. And I hope listening to that, maybe next year, one of you will want to go to Barcelona. So yeah, if you're going to a tournament next week, I think the big tournament that we're all going to be watching is the Madrid Open. So if anyone's going to the Madrid Open, wants been to the Madrid Open before, you want to give us a little anecdote, send us an email. It's groundpasspodcast@gmail.com. I'm going to put it in our show notes. Send us a voicemail, an email, whatever you like, and we will play it in the next episode.
And I absolutely love it. I mean, Michelle, you sent us a follow-up telling us how things worked out, and I'm very pleased to hear that your child actually does like tennis now. So that made me very happy. And Eleanor, very happy to hear from you as well. We've interacted a lot on social media, but it's really nice to hear your voice and get to know you a little bit better. So I think Barcelona sounds great, especially if you are a clay court tennis fan, if you're a Rafa Nadal fan, seeing a court that kind of bears his name. So that was a great time. So it's like a great time at Barcelona. We'll obviously bring you up to date as to whether who wins out of Tsitsipas and Ruud. But with other things that kind of happened, I think they were kind of the main things that were going on in Barcelona. I can't think of any other stories or players from the tournament, it was kind of dominated by the fact that Carlos Alcaraz didn't play to a certain extent. And
yeah,
was bummed about, probably, and now very concerned about when
he's Well, I had Nadal for two
you
matches.
Did have Nadal.
So that was the other big thing that was happening in Barcelona. Yes, I had Nadal for two matches. So that was really nice to see Nadal back on court. You know, he's not the same player, obviously. He's dealing with his body, and this is presumably his last year on tour. But it was nice to see that he could still pull out matches and win. And he won his first round match, but lost to Dimonor in the second round, which was fine. So Barcelona was the story of that. I think Barcelona was also the story of Andrei Rublev, and he hasn't really won a match since the default situation in Dubai. And I think he should take some time off, but that's not for me to say. That's for him to decide. But that I think those are the...
Like, that man plays way too much tennis.
He plays a lot of tennis. So I think those are the main stories of Barcelona. And yes, we will bring you, follow us on social media. You know, we'll bring you all the news and break, you know, results of tournaments and champions and all of that. So if you follow us on social media, guess what? Nick is now on Threads. We finally brought him over. So Nick is now on Threads, and the Ground Pass Thread account will be reposting things that Nick posts, because Nick always post like sort of matches you're watching. You talk a lot about the WTA as well, and I think a lot of your posts are sort of you. It's a back and forth between you and the audience. You ask a lot of questions, and so people can engage in those. So we'll repost all of that so you can take part. So that was Barcelona. We also had Munich,
which we literally. Had the results of
literally. On our television right now. If this was a video podcast, if this was a video podcast, you would have seen me cheering for Jan Lennard Struff, who at 33 years old has finally won his very first tournament at the ATP Tour level. So happy for him. I think he came onto my I noticed him first during the Madrid Open last year. So almost a year ago, where he went from qualifying and got to the finals and lost to Carlos Alcaraz in the finals. And he's been on and off ever since. I think he had a little bit of a boost after that tournament, but then he was out for injury and then he came back. So he's been off and on since then. And now the clay season has begun again and he's back and he's finally won a tour. You know, he's German. I don't think he is from Munich. I'm not sure, but it's nice to win at home, I guess. And that be his first title ever. Excited to see what he can do on clay, because it seems to be his surface, which he is a big server. I think he's 6'5". He's super tall, really, really big server. He beat, Holger Rune in the semifinals in 44 minutes, mostly because he kept acing him on clay. He doesn't seem like the sort of player who you'd be like, oh, he's a great clay court player, but a lot of his great results are on the clay surface. So excited for him, happy he's finally crossed the line of winning a tournament.
Yeah, he Struff, for a lot of established tennis fans, as someone's like, is he finally going to win a tournament? So this is a very good feel-good story for a lot of tennis fans. It's interesting you talk about Struff and clay. Like, yes, I think he's very comfortable on it. I think he's what like long-term fans would call a natural surfaces player. That means that basically strong on clay and grass. Like, if you think that sort of hard being artificial, you have to lay cement or whatever to make it. Whereas clay grass is natural. It comes from the ground. Clay looks like it comes from the ground, but we talked about that already. The other story from Munich, to be honest, wasn't even the players. It was the weather.
Wow.
So bizarre. Given it's spring, right? We expect a few rain showers and the forecast wasn't looking good. The finalists are currently wrapped up and wearing long sleeves. Struff is like covers his arms and his legs. And it snowed at one point. which is madness. I think that's going to be our overriding memory from Munich, and probably the thing that made us kind of take a step back for a moment.
Yeah, so that was what was going on the men's side. There was another tournament, the Tirak Open. I didn't watch most of it. The only matches I watched were the ones played by João Fonseca. He was there. Again, he's this sort of young phenom, really great player. So I try and catch his matches if I can. The final of that is currently happening right now, which involves Martin Fucsovics, who, if you don't know who that is, I'm going to find a photo of him in his sort of his preferred attire, which is usually shirtless. And I will put it in our show notes.
I was worried when you were going with that, because I think if I was talking, I would have got all his glory, which probably would have set up a very different expectation. But yes, that's generally what Martin Fucsovics is known for. So if you enjoy seeing a somewhat ripped human male, it's there in the show notes for you. We're not usually that kind of podcast.
No, but it's one of those things when he's, you know, you associate different things with players. And every time I think of him, I'm like, he's just shirtless all the time. No?
It's like, you turn on the TV and you're disappointed that he's wearing a shirt. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. He should, if any player should probably wear the sort of cut off sleeveless thing that Nadal does sometimes, Martin Fucsovics should be one of those. But moving on, Nick, what has been happening on the WTA?
So we are in Stuttgart. We've got two tournaments going on. The main one being in Stuttgart, which was packed. Like all the top players were there, pretty much, with one or two exceptions. The top four seeds, Świątek, Sabalenka, Rybakina, Goff, all there. We had a few top 10 players, Ostapenko, Vondrousova, Emma Raducanu got a wild card, Angie Herbert got a wild card. I guess for me, the overriding story of Stuttgart was the insane amount of high quality matches that came out of that event. Like,
it's almost like a WTA final.
It was.
It's
like,
so good.
I treat it as like the secondary WTA finals, which, bit of tennis history for you, there actually did used to be two WTA finals a year, one in the spring and one in the winter.
Oh.
Yeah. Way back in the 80s. The WTA tour was split into two tours at the time.
Okay.
One, they had like a mini circuit for the first 3 months of the year, and then they had the main circuit that happened the rest of the time. Tangent aside, the Stuttgart, yeah, I treat that as like a secondary WTA finals. I am now seriously considering going next year, although I will say that apparently it's sold out really quick. So if you want to go to Stuttgart, if you're listening from Germany or from not in Germany, those tickets go, so be hot on it. Especially if they keep getting the kind of fields that they get. Stuttgart is, we got some absolute blockbusters, I said, at least 12 three-set matches, all of which were noteworthy for some form of drama, especially the ones involving Marta Kostyuk. And there were one or two straight sets matches that were actually really, really good quality, like Iga Świątek taking on Emma Raducanu, who were like the two of the form players of the week. Even though that was straight sets, that was really, really good. And the result of that came in about half an hour ago, or about like 45 minutes ago. Elena Rybakina has won the title in Stuttgart and is taking home the trophy and a Porsche, despite not having a driver's license. And so Anastasia is probably...
She's going to have to get one.
She is. Like, a Porsche should be enough incentive to get yourself a driving license. But I remember our last podcast, Anastasia, you said that, that Porsche was like perfect color for you and everything else like that. Like, Elena Rybakina, if you can't drive it, can you at least let Anastasia have a go?
If you're listening, I'm available to babysit your car while you get a driver's license. Thank you,
Anastasia.
Porsche.
Need to travel to Europe.
I will go.
Yeah, and Rybakina won the tournament. Partly because she took down Iga Świątek, who had never lost in Stuttgart before in her career. It was a really hard fought match. Like, the margins between the two of them were so fine. Only 5 points in it. They both had so many breakpoint chances on each other's serves. It was fascinating seeing the dynamics of sort of Rybakina was trying to get the points done quick and get it done within a few shots. Iga was waiting to just sort of line things up and work the point in her favor. And it was a fascinating dynamic in that semi-final. But Rybakina got the job done and seems to be emerging as the main rival to Iga Świątek on the WTA Tour in 2024. Obviously, we don't want to get too ahead of ourselves because Sabalenka's still there. Goff is still there. But right now, those two are being even more consistent than anyone else right now. And I'm fully expecting to see those two run into each other, which sets up a fascinating run-in in Madrid to see what kind of momentum can be done, whether Świątek can be set, whether Rybakina can kind of carry the fitness a bit. Yeah, that's the result, is Rybakina came through a really tough draw in what was a very good week of tennis. If you just watched Stuttgart, you had a great week because you blocked the opponent every day. The final was a bit more straightforward, not surprising. Rybakina was in form. Kostic was probably running out of gas a little bit.
Yeah. I was saying I didn't watch much of Barcelona because I was watching Munich, but I was also watching Stuttgart. Like I remember I posted, I put a post up on Ground Pass about all the quarterfinals, and every single one was a major event, you know? So I think coming out of Stuttgart, my main stories are first of all, you know, Emma Raducanu is back, baby. Like, it's so nice to see her play her brand of tennis and be healthy and comfortable doing it and happy on court, because I think she could definitely be a force. She pushed Iga, and she hasn't been playing much this year. She's still building back her ranking and building back matches and stuff. So I'm expecting, you know, I'm expecting big things. I don't know what big things I'm expecting, but I'm excited now to watch her play tournaments and see how far she can get and see her against top 10 players more often, basically. So I'm really excited for that. It seems like she's gotten a wild card into Madrid.
Yeah,
so
she's basically announced it, because Madrid haven't actually announced any wild card.
Right.
But she's just basically said that she's on the plane to Madrid, and given that she doesn't have the ranking to get in automatically, we're going to safely assume she had a wild card.
What else other than Stuttgart?
Rouen is happening, which I won't talk about too deeply because there wasn't that many top players there. Naomi Osaka, first match on clay, immediately lost, not surprised, to Martina Trevisan. Not surprised. She'd literally just come over from Japan and clay does not suit her game. Like, she literally hopped on a plane straight after Japan and then had to fly over to France and then play. Like, even the Caroline Pliskovas of the world would struggle with that time zone jump. But the Mira Andreeva was in action as well. Got to the quarterfinals. Seems to have recovered from whatever injury was ailing her kind of in February, March. Was holding her back a bit. Seems to be back on song, which is good to see. For me, the story of
has a new coach.
Yes, Conchita Martinez, who won Wimbledon 30 years ago. Was the coach of Garbiñe Muguruza, who yesterday announced that she was retiring aged 30. So she was she's kind of done with tennis. She wants to go and live her best life now.
Yeah.
Having won two Grand Slams, who can blame her? Let's be honest. But for me, I think the big story of the tournament will be interesting, because that final has just got started in Rouen, is whether Sloane Stephens can win it. Because she's in the final right now. And Sloane Stephens on clay, that seems to be the niche that she's carved for herself in her career since winning the US Open. And she has been motoring through draws. In fact, like, she was looking really good in Charleston until she ran into the unstoppable force is Danielle Collins. Sloane always seems to have an impact at Roland Garros. I think she's a name that fans should be marking as keeping an eye on in this clay court season. But don't forget, she is a former French Open finalist as well. But yeah, Sloane on clay, that seems to be the direction that she seems to want to specialise in.
So that's what's been going on in tour. I hope everyone had a great week of tennis. We have a great 2 weeks of tennis coming up because we have our next 1000 level event, joint event, which are my favorite, in Madrid. So the Madrid Open is coming up. It's going to be from the 24th of April to the 5th of May, and it's a joint 1000 level event. So you'll have all the top players, fingers and toes crossed, we will have all the top players playing.
Well, we already know we won't with one of them. Novak Djokovic isn't playing.
That we do know. That was actually a weird, I don't know how to put this. It was interesting because he didn't play it last year.
No.
He did not play the Madrid Open last
year.
So I've always, at least in the last few years, Novak Djokovic has always been someone where I feel his schedule is play the big tournament right before the Grand Slam and then play the Grand Slam. So I almost never expect him to be anywhere else other than that. And so that would mean he would play Rome and then the French Open. So even though it was maybe a bit of a surprise, I almost have to say I wasn't even thinking about it. I wasn't even thinking, oh, Novak's going to be here or not. And maybe that's just because that's just how I feel about the way he deals with his schedule now.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I completely agree. He is someone who very much schedules everything around trying to still win the big events because he's won everything else, apart from the Olympics. And he's going to be scheduling, probably putting some kind of schedule together to prepare for that. As possible.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the men's event is going to be about whether Carlos Alcaraz is healthy. If not, it's going to be pretty wide open to see what Sinner can do, whether Tsitsipas and Ruud can continue to be in the mix on clay. Are Runa and Zverev going to pick themselves back up? That seems to be the narratives for the men's tournament. Women's side, it's going to continue to be, is anyone able to take down Świątek on clay? Because the reality is in the last few years, Świątek has lost one match a year on clay and it's been an epic three-setter every single time. So if you're going to bring it,
yeah,
you've got to bring it. I'm not counting the Rybakina retirement in Rome against Rybakina last year. Like a retirement's a very different scenario. But and even then that went to a third set. So to me, like the women's tournament will be about, does anyone have the capability of taking down Iga again?
Right. And the big thing about Madrid again, kind of like what we talked about with Will, is the new doubles setup. So on the ATP side, and this will be very interesting because I think in the conversation we had with Will, I brought this up. On the women's side, a lot of singles players already play a lot of doubles. Take Coco Gauff and Jessica Pegula, for example. They always play doubles together. So it's never been sort of like, oh, they're playing doubles. It wasn't quite an event. But at the Madrid Open on the ATP side, it is a 32-pair draw, and they have saved 16 of those for single specialist to double up and play. It's part of their experiment to see how they can sort of draw fans into the doubles tournaments and watch them. So, you know, I'm hoping we can see pairings like Rublev and Khachanov, who won the Madrid Open in doubles last year. I hope we can see my favorite new doubles pairing, which is Thomas Mahach and Triple Z. They got to the semifinals of Barcelona and they lost. And I can't remember now if they got to the finals of the Australian Open or the semifinals of the Australian Open. I can't remember, but they're a really great singles player double pairing that I like.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I would imagine like with Espresso Triple Z, his ranking's probably not super high, so he's probably still going to play doubles regardless of the rule. So yeah, it will be interesting. Same with Hatch, actually. So it'll be interesting to see how they get on in there. And like, yeah, the doubles tournament is going to be...
Yeah, another singles pairing doubles. I don't know what we should call them, but I'll figure it out.
Sinner has been playing a lot with Lorenzo Sonego. They've been pairing up a lot.
I reckon that's going to happen in Rome.
Ooh, that would be, oh, can you imagine? It would be a lot. Italians in Rome.
Medal attempt for Italy.
Definitely.
There is one thing that I think might mark Madrid down, though, that I've discovered, which is they don't actually have a ground pass ticket. To be fair, so basically, obviously, you can get in smaller courts, but you have to buy either a main stadium ticket or a court two ticket. I think it's like the stadiums are Manolo Santana, which is the main one, and then Arantha Sanchez Vicario is the second one. And they're pretty reasonably priced, particularly Arantha Sanchez Vicario stadium. You're only getting in there for like 20, 30, 40 euros. If that, and obviously you can get around. But yes, I would imagine that if you're going to buy stadium tickets, you may as well be on the stadium unless you really want to see a certain player. So a little bit tongue-in-cheek with the ground pass comment, but it's something for going to be aware of, is that once again, there are some people who are being somewhat overlooked by the tournament. Ground pass fans.
You know, going to write a strongly worded letter to Madrid.
Do you speak Spanish?
I do. And I'm going to write it in Spanish and I'm going to send it. And we're like, we should have a ground pass. But it is nice that the tickets are reasonable enough. And then you can get onto the outside courts and take a look at that. That's the joy of tournaments in Europe and these reasonable ground passes or stadium tickets that can get you around. Thanks for bringing that up. That was a really great point. And hopefully people who are going to the tournament, reach out and let us know what the experience was like. I'll leave all the ways you can contact us in our show notes. So we have come to the end of the podcast, but we can't leave you without talking about our players of the fortnight. Nick, you have a player. Who is it?
Emma Raducanu, because... although she's not necessarily a name that isn't already pretty well known, I would assume even if you're newer to tennis, you will have heard of Emma Raducanu. That US Open 2021 run was headline news in the UK, in the US, around the world. So early in her career to win a major, huge result, and especially in the way that she did. But this is the first, for 2 weeks, she has played that kind of tennis that took her to that title. It's been pretty patchy. I think that's due to the injuries she's been struggling with. But the last couple of weeks, she was really hitting through her forehand. Her serve was magnificent. She was picking off her opponents on her return, like winning sets comfortably. Świątek, she went toe-to-toe with. Świątek had a little bit more on clay. It's Świątek on clay. She's very, very hard to deal with. Only the very, very best can beat Świątek on clay. And I'm talking like Sabalenka, Rybakina. Raducanu's not there yet, but she could be. But like being the hero of GB in the Billie Jean King Cup, where she was the MVP, she won both of her matches. And then having a really good run to the quarterfinals in Stuttgart, performing strongly over those 2 weeks and giving hope that the potential she showed at the US Open to be a world-class, world-leading player is still there. Regardless of whether you think she was overhyped or not, I think there was a lot of contextual factors into why she didn't immediately become the greatest of all time after winning the US Open in her first attempt. I think Raducanu is a name that you should get used to seeing and hearing us talking about. So, yeah, Emma Raducanu is my player of the week. I will give a shout out to Marta Kostyuk for helping make Stuttgart so entertaining.
Yay. So happy you picked Emma because, again, I think, yes, it is a name that in the tennis world and even outside of the tennis world is such a recognizable name. I keep seeing her Dior campaign video that just came out. I see it everywhere now. So I'm just like, oh, that's a tennis player. It's Emma Raducanu. But everyone knows who she is. But she's definitely having a moment coming back from injury and excited to see her in the future. And you know, I'm going for the winner of the tournament. But Jan Lennart Struff is my player of the fortnight. I think he's not a name that most people would be able to pick out of a hat. He is not a well-known player. He's currently ranked, he's in the top 30. Again, I think his big run last year kind of brought him into the spotlight a little bit when he went from qualifying and then got into the finals of the Madrid Open last year. He had a great match. It was the semifinal match against Aslan Karatsev, who, if Aslan was playing now, would probably be someone I would pick for player of the fortnight. But Aslan's currently injured. But that was a really great storyline of the Madrid Open last year. And Jan Lennart Struff, he's 33. He's been doing this for a while, but just has not won a tournament. And if you're in your 30s and you have the weapons that he does, he has a great serve. You just expect he's won something, a 250 or anything, and he just hasn't. He's been in a lot of finals and just hasn't crossed the line. So really great to see him finally get a win, especially at home. And hopefully we will see him more on tour. I think things have changed a little bit. Definitely, we've had sort of Novak, you know, playing late into his 30s has sort of introduced this sort of, you know, you don't always have to be retired by 30. You can if you want to, that's fine. But I think players have the possibility of having a little bit more longevity on tour. And maybe this is sort of a new renaissance moment for Jan Lennart Struff. So he's early 30s. He might still be able to play way into his 40s if he wanted to, which, bringing that up, he is actually about to play doubles now. I didn't realize, but he's also in the doubles final at the Munich Open. So after this trophy ceremony that is actually still going, he's going to go play doubles.
How is that
still? It's still happening.
Like, he won.
I know, he won a while ago.
Okay. It's probably all the executives from BMW, right?
Literally every... Oh, there's a BMW on court. So funny you say that. There's literally a BMW on court.
I think Munich might be one of those ones where, like, there's a car involved.
Yeah. I wonder if he wins the car. Interesting.
Because it used to be... there was a tournament once where you, like, at one point in Germany, where you could win a Mercedes. Basically, if you want to be a tennis player, try and win a tournament in Germany.
Chances are you'll get a car.
Try not to win a
tournament. Yeah, Jan Lennart Struff. Yeah. I don't. What did he do with the cow? Where is the cow? I have so many questions about that cow, because I recently just saw a video of it. I'm like, where is the cow?
I mean, it is 20 years ago. That cow was probably steak, or was steak.
No, don't say that. It's a cute cow. It was a really cute furry cow.
Well, I don't know what else you would do with a cow if it wasn't going to live much longer.
Me neither.
Maybe more humane ways of disposing of it. But that's where my mind went. Yeah, for those who don't know what we're talking about 20 years ago, Roger Federer won the Swiss Open, and it took him several attempts to do it, and he finally won it, and he was gifted with a cow on court, and there was a lot of... He was somewhat bemused by that, which is what Anastasia and I are talking about.
Yeah, I think someone should just ask Roger, so we know where you keep all your trophies, but where's the cow?
Again, Anastasia, regardless of what happened to it, cows don't live that long. I don't think a cow lives for 20 years.
Okay, fine. But anyway, Jan Lennart Struff is my player of the fortnight. A close second was João Fonseca. In fact, João Fonseca's name was typed in our show note document up until Jan Lennart Struff won the tournament, and I had to switch. I love João Fonseca. He's someone who I'm sure I will be talking about more and more in the future. But definitely had to go with Jan Lennart Struff for this one.
Right choice, I think.
So that's this week. That's this week in Ground Pass. We will come back to you next week, where I will be doing a mini pod,
And then Nick and I will join you again in 2 weeks at the end of the Madrid Open to recap the Madrid Open and talk about what's coming next, which will be Rome. And the more and more I think about it, I'm like, this is a really busy, busy time. I know we always say this. I know we're always like, there's so much tennis going on and always, but these are all required for the most part tournaments. And you think of someone like Stefanos Tsitsipas, who won Monte Carlo. He's in the finals of Barcelona. He has to play Madrid because it's required. He has to play Rome because it's required. And then it's the French Open. That's a lot. Tennis.
This is the bit where the players are, yeah, because you could structure your season around which tournaments you're required to play if you're a top 30-40 player, and yeah, if it's around here is where you really are on the road, moving from place to place a lot, and not a lot of respite either, because obviously you do want to have some warm up on grass. I think with it being an Olympic year as well, this season's going to be pretty intense. We probably won't be taking a breather until after the US Open in September.
Yeah.
We can do this. Marathon, not a sprint. It's been fun as always, Anastasia.
Exactly. Well, thank you, everyone, and I will see you next week.